Hello, survivalists. This is The Crux, True Survival Stories. I'm your host, Casey McIntosh, and Julie Henningsen today is leading the story. Julie, take it away.
Hi, Casey. Thank you. I got a good one for you today. You're going to like this one. It hits close to home for both of us. So we're going to talk today about the Butte, Montana, Granite Mountain Speculator Mine Disaster of 1917. Do you know anything about this, Casey?
No, but it's really sad that I don't, because my grandmother lives in Butte. Do you have any Butte statistics for us?
Well, I have to admit, the reason I chose this story is because I wanted an excuse to talk about Butte and how awesome it is. And as a shout out to you, because I know that Butte is a town that's close to your heart and that you have family there. We're gonna talk about the Speculator Mine Disaster, which is still remains to this day to be the most deadly event in hard rock mining in U.S. history. Yeah, to this day. But it also just is such a interesting historical example of how the town of Butte, Montana, or Butte, America, as we like to call it, evolved into what it is today, which is a really unique and amazing place. Montanans know this, but people outside Montana may not realize some of the amazing facts and history of this cool town.
Like parties for St. Patrick's Day, primarily. That's what Butte's known for.
That is absolutely what it's famous for today, is the best St. Patty's Day events you can imagine. Butte was a huge mining town. Mining began there in the late 1800s, originally for silver and gold. And because of this mining boom, it attracted immigrants from all over the world. Finns, Italians, Germans, Chinese, Serbs. Butte in the late 1800s, first half of the 1900s, was by far the most ethnically diverse city that Montana has probably ever seen. And the Irish immigrants were one of the more predominant ethnic groups. At one point, one quarter or 25% of the residents of Butte in the early 1900s were Irish. And the population today of Butte is still really known for the many residents of Irish ancestry. Hence the amazing St. Patrick's Day festivities and other Irish festivals that happen often in Butte. So mining was off to a big start in the early 1800s for silver and gold, but they started to find copper in the Butte Hill, which is basically the big hill that is Butte. And the timing for this was perfect, because that was right around the time when electricity was coming online. And what do you need for electricity but copper? So suddenly, almost overnight, the Butte copper mining industry just took off. And the town of Butte had over 100,000 people at one point. It was the largest city between Chicago and San Francisco. It was huge, diverse, rich. People were making a ton of money off of the copper mine. And many families and young men were flocking there to make money in the underground hard rock mining.
I would love to have a glimpse of what Butte was like at that time. If you could just be a fly on the wall and just see what a sight it was, because as I'm sure you're going to tell us, there was obviously a big change in how profitable copper was at some point.
Yeah. Yeah, there have been a lot of changes. How profitable copper was, how safe or unsafe mining is. There currently is no underground mining at all in Butte. There have been really dramatic shifts for a whole variety of social and environmental reasons over the last 100 years in this story. But back in this boom time, just a couple more interesting things about Butte and what life was like there. The city had the largest red light district in the American West, as you can imagine. Tens of thousands of mining men. So big, active red light district. There were 9 railroads coming in and out of Butte. And at one time, it supplied over 25% of the world's copper, the entire world's copper. So really heavily producing. Yeah, it's a lot. They were just sucking copper out of that ground. Over the lifespan of the hard rock mining operations in Butte, $48 billion of wealth have been unearthed from the richest hill on earth. That's what Butte is known as, the richest hill on earth. $48 billion. And in these days, a lot of that money was going straight to the Copper Kings. The Copper Kings were the titans of industry who were competing with each other at the top of the mining food chain to make the most money as they could from this industry. There it was Augustus Hines, Marcus Daly, whose name you recognize if you're a Montanan, and a guy by the name of William Clark, who lived in the Copper King Mansion, which is still stands in Butte. You can go spend the night at the Copper King Mansion, or at least tour it. So a lot of history that's still there. So anyway, oh, here's another interesting thing about Butte. Butte still is home to the oldest operating Chinese restaurant in America. It's called the Peking Noodle Parlor. And it's still, you can still go eat there today. Have you ever been there, Casey?
No, I was just going to ask you the same thing. Have you ever eaten there?
I haven't, but geographically, Butte is in between where I live and where you live, as you know. So I think we should meet for lunch at the Peking Noodle Parlor one of these days and go say hi to your grandma.
That sounds great. It will take you an hour to get there. It will take me 4 hours. So I'm going to have to get an
Yeah.
earlier start than you.
Sounds good to me. Okay, so let's try and keep this in a logical order here. I just want to tell you a little bit. I want to paint a picture here so you understand a little bit about what it was like to be a miner in Butte in 1917. So, the underground mines, and why am I telling you this now? Because I just went on the Butte underground mining tour last weekend with my family. It was amazing. It really lit a
Seriously?
fire. I'm serious. Yeah, it really lit a fire to dig deeper, no pun intended, in some of this history. This stuff is amazing. It's wild to me how much things have changed. And you'll agree when you hear what these folks were doing back then. So these mines go up to 3,200 feet, actually, even deeper, underground, almost a mile underground. And I'm going to just talk about this like you don't know anything about mining, because I knew nothing about this when I went on the tour, and I was amazed by what I learned. So I'll just share. So they create these mine shafts that are like skinny little narrow kind of elevator shafts that go up to a mile down underground. And then at many different levels, sometimes every 100 feet, there's different stations where if you imagine this narrow elevator shaft, the elevator, which is not an elevator, it's just a narrow cage that's being pulled with a counterbalance by gravity. But anyway, you can stop at these different stations, and then there's tunnels that lead in all different directions from the shafts. And there's a bunch of shafts, and at the top of the shafts are the head frames, which are the big wooden 100-foot tall structures that look almost like a gallows. And then once you get underground, many of the tunnels that come off in all different directions from these shafts end up connecting up with each other. So there's this huge network of tunnels that you can just go through. There's 10,000, over 10,000 miles of connected tunnels under the town of Butte. And some of those tunnels are literally a mile underground. So that's how extensive this is.
That's crazy. And just imagine the engineering that goes into doing something like that because you want it to be structurally sound so they're not falling apart.
Yeah, you want it to be structurally sound. I get a really strong impression that safety was not a priority for the workers, but they want it structurally sound so that it can pump out the copper and make the money. And that's where their incentives, the disaster that I'm going to tell you about, it did result in some improved safety conditions, and you'll understand why, but that was not, worker safety was not something they thought about back in this time frame. So these mostly young men would clock in to work. And there were three shifts a day. There was like the morning shift, the swing shift, and the night shift. So these minds were operating around the clock. And they come in the locker room, change into their gear. They grab a little tag from the clocking in chart. It's like hooks, tags on a hook. And they move it to the chart that says I'm underground. And then when they come out at the end of the day, they have to move their tag back to the kind of clocking out board so that the foreman, the supervisor, can look at the board and determine if anybody didn't come out for that day. If there's still a tag on the underground side of the board, then they, you know, start to worry about, okay, maybe someone didn't come out. So they do a kind of a hasty search for this person that didn't get their tag moved. And I bet you'll know the answer to this. If they can't find him right away underground, where do you think they looked?
The bar.
You got it. They went to the bar. And that's usually where they found him, because part of their compensation, part of their pay, was the first beer was free when their shift ended. They got out of the mine, they moved their tag, they went to the bar and had a beer. So if they were found at the bar, forgot to move their tag to the clock out board, they were fired. That was a fireable offense. But don't worry, because they could get a job the next day at another mine right next door. There was plenty of work to be had. So that would happen occasionally. So these miners, they show up, they get ready to go, and they get in these little tiny, I'm going to call it a cage, because it's like a dirty, tiny elevator that is a cage. Few people can fit in it. And then there's a hoist operator that drops them down into the mine. So they get to wherever station they're going to go. And back in these days, before air compressors and drills, what they would do is they'd work in teams of two by candlelight. They had to buy and pay for their own candles. So they were really stingy with candles. Two people would share one candle. And they did everything they could to make sure the candle didn't run out while they were down there, because then that would be pitch black, which was, you know, their worst fear, or maybe their second worst fear. But they're doing all this work by the light of a candle in teams of two. So one person would hold this iron rod that's maybe like 3 feet long. And then the other person would take this big mallet or sledgehammer. And while their partner's holding the iron rod against the rock, they just repeatedly sledgehammer the rod into the rock. And they just, sometimes they'd sing songs, they'd just get a little rhythm going of just hitting the rod with the hammer all day long. And they would work an 8 to 10 hour shift, just slamming that rod into the rock. And the objective was to sink the rod about 5 feet into the rock and then create five foot holes in the rock. The five holes are shaped like you would picture the five dots on a dice, on a die, in that kind of orientation. Each of those holes is 5 feet deep. And then they can slide dynamite down in there, light the dynamite, and then they blow the rock open. So how far, if you had to guess, how deep do you think they could sink that rod in the rock by repeatedly hammering it in one shift in 8 to 10 hours? How much headway do you think they made in creating those holes?
That's like how many feet of headway? Is that kind of what you're asking?
That is what I'm asking, but I'm going to give you a hint.
15.
It's better to say how many inches of headway.
What?
Yes, it would take two people 8 to 10 hours, an entire shift, to get that rod about 8 inches into the rock. And they had to do that 5 times to a depth of 5 feet. So that is how tedious this work was. They're hardly getting anything done when they're doing it by hand, which is how they did it.
That would seem so pointless if you were working down there. It's crazy.
Yes.
We've complained about our jobs before.
Never again.
We need to stop. When you think you're having a bad day at work, just picture, you know, smacking a rock wall for 8 hours.
Yeah, and making it 8 inches into the rock. And then doing it again and again and again. 7 days a week. And they've got paid $40 a week was kind of the going rate at that time. Plus the free beer.
How does that compare to the other wages? Was that considered a really good wage?
It was considered a good wage. Yeah, that was good money. It was worth it to the folks that were doing that work. There was more wealth per citizen in Butte at this time than any other comparable place.
Wow. You know what I was thinking I would like to do in Butte, if I was living in Butte in this time frame, I would be the person making the candles.
Yeah, making the candles. Yep. That's a great role to play. You're above ground. You're not slamming a metal rod repeatedly.
Also, it's good work security.
Yeah, it's good work security. So as time, okay, and just a little bit more background. So they would finally get the dynamite in there after, you know, seemingly months of pounding these holes. They'd blow up the rock. Then they'd load all the chunks into a ore cart, and the cart would be pulled back to the mine shafts by mules. And the mules lived down there. The veterinarian would come down underground to do the vet work. They never saw the surface until they were retired. The mules' average work span was like 8 years. And when they did bring them up to the surface, they were blind for forever because they were in the dark for their whole life. But the mules would pull these one... Yeah, it's crazy.
All of the animal lovers out there right now are just feeling really squeamish about that. I can't imagine that.
Yeah. And apparently the mules, you know, they were well suited for that work. Mules like a job. If you've spent any time around mules, that's one thing that is evident. They like a job and they like a routine. And so there are some things about this that made mules the preferred labor source in that environment. So the mules would pull these carts full of rock back to the mine shafts, and then in these little cages or elevator shafts that the workers came down in, the hoist operator would pull the carts of rock back up to the top, and then they'd get usually transported by rail to a smelter where they melt it all down and separate the copper from the waste, which is called slag. That's something I learned. The waste, the mining waste. And at this time, in the early 1900s, copper was so valuable that they would put silver and gold into the slag, into the waste, because it wasn't as valuable as the copper. They just wanted as much copper as they could get. So there's a lot of silver and gold in mining slag from that era. And that's how it all worked. Temperatures in the mine would reach 100 degrees, 90 degrees, 100 degrees.
And in the winter, it was probably horrible. Or was it always, was the temperature in the winter?
You know,
do you find anything about that?
Yeah, I thought it would be cold, but it's actually hot. There's this thing called the geothermal gradient, which I didn't know much about, but it's just the deeper you get into the earth, basically, the hotter it gets. The temperature, average temperature will increase about 1 degree for every 70 feet deep that you go. So they were just so deep in the earth that the temperatures were really hot year round.
That had to be really strange going into the mine in the middle of winter when the temperature outside is 30 degrees and you're going into 100 degree temperatures to go to work.
Yeah. Probably felt good for about 15 minutes, and then you're probably miserable for 8 hours and 45 minutes before it was over. And then you got to go to the bar, have your beer. Okay.
The other career option that would have been a better choice is just to be a brewmaster.
Yes. You know they were making money too. And they're getting paid directly by the Copper Kings, so it was reliable income.
That is a good business model.
Okay, so here we find ourselves, June 8th, 1917. It's the night shift, and the workers clock in, and they get on there in the little skippies. The skippy is the name of the cart you stand in to get lowered down into the mine, and they get brought down to their stations. They start tinking on their metal rods, digging their holes, and the irony of this tragedy is the mine was in the process of setting up some safety systems. And one of the safety systems that they were installing this day was an electric cable that was 2,500 feet long. and it was going to be an important part of a new fire alarm system that they were putting in place. So the cable, which I saw on this mining tour, is covered in lead. There's a lead sheath around the exterior of the cable. And on the inside, the cable is wrapped with paraffin, which is really flammable, and paper and cloth, basically lots of flammable things, but coated and covered and protected with lead. So they're lowering this cable 2,500 feet down a mine shaft, straight down, and it dropped. Somehow they lost control of it. Instead of it being a controlled lower, this whole heavy cable just fell to the bottom. And when it landed, a lot of the copper that was covering the exterior of the cable shattered and broke. And so there was now kind of exposed materials from inside that cable, the flammable paraffin and paper. So in response to this dropping of the cable, one of the foremen, whose name was Ernest Salau, went down to where the cable landed, and they had recently gone from working with candles, as I mentioned, to working with carbide headlamps, which are basically just a fuel-powered headlamp that has a little flame, literally a flame, on their helmets. Or who knows if they're even wearing helmets, but around their heads. So Ernest, trying to figure out what had happened with this cable that fell, he bent way over to look really closely at it. Yeah, and the carbide fueled flame on his lamp lit the paraffin and the paper on fire. And because it was extending the entire length of this shaft, the whole cable just went up in flames and carried that fire 2,500 feet up to the surface. And it was like it quickly turned that shaft into behaving like a chimney. And the fire spread really fast. Those shafts, mine shafts, and then the drafts, which are the tunnels that connect shaft to shaft, the kind of horizontal tunnels are called drafts. Those have heavy fans installed to try and get fresh air and circulating air in there to keep the air movement for the miners as fresh as they can. But in that situation, these powerful ventilating fans just pulled the fire into all the shafts and tunnels, and it just spread quickly, and primarily the smoke and oxygen was getting burnt up really quickly.
I can imagine in this situation, it's complete pandemonium, and probably everyone is panicking, and you can't get out of there quickly. That's the thing, right? Like, how many people can come up and down at a time? One?
Like five.
Oh, okay. Five at a time.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're relying on someone to manually elevate you, right?
Yes, you're right. There's this really elaborate system where the people, and we'll say five people, go in the skippy, which is the little cage. And then there's an operator that it's not Morse code, but it's like Morse code. They have their own internal code where he rings a bell, you know, ring it twice and then a pause and then three times or whatever the message is. And the person on the surface interprets that message and then will know when to pull the cart up, where to stop it, where they're getting on, where they're getting off. So it's like very elaborate and complex and nuanced and not something that in a panicky situation would be really easy to do. But nonetheless, so they were trying to evacuate.
How many people were down in the mine during this point in time?
Yes, good question. So that evening when the shift started, 410 men, they're all men, went down in the mine. So there was 410 lowered into the shaft. And that was on the early evening, whenever the night shift starts. And very shortly after, at 8 p.m., is when this cable fell. So early on in their shift. And so even though it's totally inefficient and difficult to move a lot of people quickly with this system, nevertheless, they're trying to get as many people out as they can. And the miners that run some of the lower stations closer to where the fire started, they were pulling them up in the skippies, and they'd reach the top, the few that they could get to the top, and the hoist operators were seeing them come to the top just charred. They just burnt alive on the trip back up in the Skippy elevator. So that was not an effective evacuation system. But what did work for some of these 410 men were just climbing ladders. Some of the shafts have these rickety, old, wooden, zigzaggy, broken ladders that go quite a ways down. So there was just a steady stream of men just manually, hand over foot, climbing these ladders to try and get out. And many did survive that way and made it to the top. Others did not. Most people did not get burnt in this fire. The vast majority, I think like 99% of the victims, died of asphyxiation because the fire burnt up all the breathable oxygen underground and they just suffocated.
Did anyone fall off of these ladders? If you're climbing the ladder and you slip, it's goodnight, sweetheart, right? Like, that's it.
Yeah. You fall. Yeah, it's just a straight up to 3,200 to a mile drop straight down in this narrow shaft. Here's the other thing to picture is, you know, this is like going to be like a steady stream of men trying to make it up this ladder in a panicky situation in a narrow tunnel, a narrow tube with potentially people falling off above you or below you. And like you said, pandemonium. Okay, so here's where there's some just moments of and Butte grit start to shine through here. The first story is about Ernest Salau, who started the fire, the foreman. Once he realized what was going on, he turned down the opportunity to ride the Skippy cart up to the surface to safety. And instead, he started running through these tunnels, and he ran more than 3 miles underground, trying to alert as many people as he could and direct them to safety before it was too late. And he didn't survive. He suffocated during this process of trying to save as many or alert as many people as he could.
I say, that's pretty crazy. I would imagine that it would be hard to live with yourself if he had gotten into the car and just left, because he was the one that started the fire to begin with. So that may have motivated him a little bit.
Yeah, I think it did. I think he felt called to help as much as he could, knowing how dire the situation was, and probably knowing that turning down that ride meant his own death. So there were two other miners that kind of, whose names went down in history books as being heroes of this incident. The first one was a miner by the name of Manus Dugan. He was a nipper. That was his job in the mine, which means he sharpened tools, and he would deliver them to miners as they were working. So he had the idea to, instead of trying to escape up and get out of the mine, he led a group of 29 miners into a what's called a blind drift. So it's basically a mining, narrow mining tunnel that just goes into nowhere and ends up against a rock wall. And there is a bulkhead at the end of it, and they positioned themselves on the other side of the bulkhead, still within the drift, the tunnel of the mine. And then they took off their clothing, got as much dirt, and plugged as many of the holes in this bulkhead as they could to keep the air out. And these 29 men just hunkered down behind this big bulkhead at the end of a blind drift and just were there to wait it out. And their survival in this situation depended on the outside air, the air outside the bulkhead clearing with smoke enough to become breathable before the air inside the bulkhead ran out. The oxygen ran out, and they kind of suffocated in this little sealed off tomb that they created for themselves. So I can just imagine how challenging that would be to, you know, entomb yourself in a burning mine shaft as your only potential hope for survival and avoiding suffocation.
The other thing about that is that how long do you wait? You just sit there, you know, how long do you give before you move? That would be really hard.
Yeah, so their plan was to just wait until they could figure out like that the air's running out, probably till the first person suffocated and they knew that it was now or never. which for them was 36 hours. They could stand it for 36 hours. They were all still alive at 36 hours, but barely alive. So after 36 hours on the verge of suffocation, they opened up this bulkhead that they'd created, and then they crawled to safety down low, and 25 of the 29 men survived and made it out, and four of them didn't make that crawl out. They suffocated on the way out. And what's really inspiring about this story is Manus Dugan, the person whose idea this was, who was leading this group, this survival group. At the end, it was his turn to jump on the shaft and ride to safety, but he chose to return to the tunnel to help these last four men and find them and see if he could help pull them out, save his companions, which he wasn't able to do. And ultimately, he didn't survive himself. He perished in that attempt.
Well, that is such a bummer because he shouldn't have gone back at that point. You know, he wasn't able to change the outcome.
Yeah. Yeah, he was just determined. And another miner who has a very similar story, who's gone down in history and fame, is J.D. Moore. He led a group really similar to what Dugan did. He led six men behind a bulkhead, and they plugged it as well as they could to keep the air from getting contaminated or getting the oxygen from getting depleted. And they stayed there for 56 hours, which makes sense. There was fewer of them, so maybe they had longer oxygenation in their space. But after 56 hours, rescuers actually freed them, and they were all six on the brink of death with suffocation. They had to be carried to the mine shaft a half a mile away to even get up. And J.D. himself did not survive, and he wrote his last will and testament on a note that they found down in that area that they were hiding out. And his note said, "You will know your Jim died like a man, and his last thought was for his wife that I love better than anyone on earth. Tell mother and the boys goodbye." So J.D. Moore and Manus Dugan are two names that you hear in association with just being heroes in this.
That's just so horrible because they probably know. Obviously, he knew he wasn't going to make it out at the point at which he's writing his last words on a piece of paper. What a sad thing.
Yeah, definitely so sad. The only kind of silver lining is that his actions and bravery really is what led at least six other people to survive. The last known survivor. So I mentioned 410 men went down in the mines that day. 155 died underground. They didn't make it out alive. And 13 others later died within about 8 days of reaching the surface. Lung injury and complications of asphyxiation. Bringing the death toll to 167. So that's what makes it the largest hard rock mining disaster in U.S. history to this day. The last known living survivor, the last person to live that made it out alive, was a guy by the name of Elmer Miller. He lived to age 96. He was 19 years old. Him and his brother Clarence were both in the mine when this happened. And they both made it out alive. And he continued to mine for several years after that, and then later moved to California and did a bunch of other things. But he survived to age 96. And you can find interesting information about his life.
I just find it interesting that you would want to continue to work in the mine after something like that happened.
Yeah, his brother Clarence, not so much. His brother wasn't into it. He went into creating a shoe company called Miller's Boots and Shoes and got out of the mine, which was probably a smart move. But Elmer, he went back. This is just one story of many. From these roots, Butte, the town of Butte, is just known for its population of really a hardworking, no-nonsense residents who really kind of approach life with this attitude of grit, resilience, and may not feel like the warmest community from the outside, but they just take care of their own. And I think that's something that lives on in that community and is really respected. There's a lot of Butte pride. It's a community that's really known for its soul and determination. And this is part of that history that's created what they have going there.
Yeah, I always feel when I'm in Butte that the community sense is probably really strong. Whenever I've gone out to the bar in Butte with my Uncle Dan, he like knows everyone that lives there.
Yeah, it is. Everyone probably knows who you are. And it's, you know, it's different. So I mentioned there was 100,000 people there at one point, and now there's less than 40,000, maybe 35,000. It's nothing like it used to be. There's no mining anymore. Over time, century of this mining and pulling out the minerals, it's left polluted water, the site of the largest environmental cleanup, a lot of toxic mine waste. And really has changed the shape of the town in a lot of ways. Okay, and then another interesting thing about this disaster was memorialized in several different songs that you might be familiar with. One's called Rocks in the Box, and it's by the Decemberists, which is an indie rock band. There's a song called The Miners by an independent Celtic recording artist, The Elders, about this mining disaster. And then Montana singer and songwriter Nick Spear wrote a song called Tapper Light, which he performed at the Granite Mountain Speculator Mine Memorial above Butte on June 8th, 2017, 100 years to the day after this disaster took place.
Wow, that's really cool. I was just thinking that we should put those songs in the description for the episode so people can...
Yeah. That's a good idea. A little background music. Yeah, I'm sure they're easy to find. Casey, have you ever spent St. Patty's Day in Butte?
I think only 1 year, maybe when I was in college, but that was it. I went to school in Bozeman, so a lot of people would go over there for St. Patrick's Day.
We'll have to reunite next March 17th, have dinner at the Peking Noodle Parlor and celebrate St. Patty's in Butte. We spent
totally
a couple years. Yeah, you know this. Matt and I and the kids lived in Whitehall for a few years, which is just one town over from Butte. So we did all of our grocery shopping and eating out in Butte and got to know that town in a way that I hadn't previously.
Yeah, I was just thinking two things about this whole situation. Number one is, can you imagine working in a mine? I don't have claustrophobia, but just like the thought of being in one of those mine shafts doesn't sit with me very well. The other thing that I was thinking about is, if this incident happened now, how many people would actually help other people? I know that's a really interesting thing to wonder, but I just am curious if there would be so much.
Yeah, it's a good question. I feel like we definitely live in a less community-oriented, more isolating world right now. I can see where it might be a more of a every man for himself type vibe in a situation nowadays, just as a product of the world we live in.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know if you'd ever get used to being in that hard, hot, narrow, claustrophobic, stale air, meals everywhere environment. This tour we went on, there was one point, as you can imagine, where the guide invited everyone to turn their headlamps off, which of course we did. And you can put your hand an inch from your face and you can't see, you would have no idea knowing it's there. It's just pitch black. So picturing those candles running out and getting disorientated in an environment like that. Or disoriented.
Right. Did you get to light a candle to see what working in the candle lit? Yeah.
The guide lit a candle. If you're ever looking for something to do off the beaten path, I can't believe I've lived here as long as I had and never did this, but it was so cool. The underground mining tour, museum tour.
Aside from going to the bar in Butte, it's not like there's a giant amount of things to do there. So it's good that that's there. I might actually check it out.
Yeah, the kids would love it. Check it out. Okay. Well, thanks for listening. Butte, America.
Yeah.
Put it on your map.
Butte, America. All right. I hope you guys have an awesome rest of your week. And again, as always, if you have any comments or if you have any specific requests for episodes, you can write us at thecruxtruesurvival@gmail.com or find us on Instagram, The Crux Podcast. And hope you have, like I said, a wonderful rest of your week. If you like listening to us, or partly enjoy it, please give us a review, share with a friend, so we can get out into more people's ears. So anyway, Julie, good to see you as always.
You too. Thanks, Casey.
Until next week. Thank you.